always encourage companies, you should be ready to sell even if you have no intention of selling. Because if someone comes to you and they want to buy the business off you, you want to put your best foot forward and you want to sell the business for what it's worth and for an optimum price for you. But good private equity, they have their ear to the ground. They have good contacts. They have good contacts in the accounting houses, in the banks. They have their ear to the ground. They're watching what's happening. They're seeing who's coming up, who's doing what.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB spend without buying ERP. Today, I'm talking to fellow Irishman Joe O'Regan from Intrinsic CFO, another fractional CFO on the podcast. Joe and I promise not to let our accents get out of control on this podcast so you can still understand what we're talking about by the end of it. We're trying to neutralize things. But there's a thread through Joe's story, which I'm particularly interested in, which is he has a traditional background in a big four accounting. But then with his banking experience as well, he's gone all the way through the funding meat grinder, let's put it that way. So he's gone all the way from someone who understands what it takes to deploy capital and the challenges around that through to helping people raise capital for their own business. And then finally, today, he works with clients who help raise client capital and also potentially look at exiting their business. And he's spun that out into his own successful fractional practice. Joe, I actually didn't warn you about this before we started. So let me throw a curveball straight away, which is tell me something about you that the listeners would not know.
That is a curveball, in fairness, which will stick with the podcast theme. I lived in Canada for a couple of years and I volunteered in the local university radio station. So I actually got some practice in producing a radio show.
Very good. I instantly feel self-conscious now because you're a professional broadcaster and I'm just a programmer with a mic.
Professional would be a stretch.
You can give me marks afterwards. Okay, so what I'd like to do is here just set up credibility because you've got some interesting learnings, but let's just make sure that you're qualified to listen to, right? So tell us a bit about your background, where you were brought up and how you got trained, so we get to orientate ourselves here.
Yeah, no problem. So I was born in Tipperary, so it's a long way for a lot of people. And I grew up on a dairy farm, something I'm very proud of. And after school, I went to university in Dublin. I studied economics and maths degree. From there, I went into banking. I qualified as an accountant. So I'm an ACCA accountant, so the Association of Chartered Certified Accountants. And I worked as a management accountant for the best part of 7 years. After that, I worked in Big Four management consultant for another 7 or 8 years. And since 2016, I've been self-employed.
Very good. And bringing up on a dairy farm, was that a spark for your entrepreneurial aspirations, as we call it that? Where were you in the family? Because typically it's the older brother who gets the farm.
I'm the older brother. No, absolutely. No, you're spot on. I guess hanging out with my dad and working with my dad, that he had that autonomy to make his own decisions. That was very attractive to me just from a young age, just to be, I suppose, in control of your own destiny, what you're doing, when you're doing it, even just having that bit of flexibility. If mid-afternoon you need to run an errand, you're not going to your boss begging, can I please just pop out for an hour? Because ultimately, working on a farm, you're working from 7, 8 o'clock in the morning till 9, 10 o'clock at night. So it doesn't really matter if you pop out for an hour between 2 and 3 in the afternoon. Whereas I felt in 9 to 5, you're nearly offering your first child just to get an hour off in the afternoon. You have to justify it and say, where are you going? Why do you need to go? And certain jobs you felt there was a bit of clock watching and not quality watching.
So having had all that, I'm sure if your Irish mammy was anything like mine, she's, that's all great being an entrepreneur. Why don't you get a safe job? And was that your motivation to go into the belly of the beast working for PwC?
Yeah, I suppose the attraction of PwC is, and it panned out as I expected. I knew I'd get great experience there. When I was around the time I had 7 years of management accounting experience, I was debating doing an MBA. I was in my mid to late 20s. The opportunity popped up in PwC. I went in there. I worked there for 5.5 years. And after PwC in the light, I didn't need to do any MBA because I just got so much good experience. Like I worked with finance directors, CFOs, advising them on the finance function. But I also straddled other areas, internal audit, procurement, corporate finance, tax. So I got really solid experience within PwC. And it's just, you're working with a variety of clients as well. So you really understand how a business works and runs. And you're working with very smart people as well. And PwC, both PwC and Deloitte, the big four model is to train your staff. You get properly trained. And I saw that with the graduates when they came in. Before they were ever working with clients, they would have spent maybe 3-4 weeks getting proper training. Like, we properly trained them in. For myself as well, I just love learning. I could list off other kind of extracurricular related qualifications I have in treasury, corporate finance, tax, etc. I just mentioned my degree, my accounting qualifications to you, but I just love learning, and they are learning organizations. You learn so much in them.
So can I ask you, I guess Ireland, it's on the edge of Europe. We're not London, we're not Paris. A lot of these projects that PwC will work on, what sort of scale of business? Were you in glass buildings or were you in outhouses and in the middle of the
clock? It very much varied. Like, you could be working in a warehouse, looking at the processes in a warehouse, understanding. So there was one project we were working on where they wanted to insource their warehouse management. So you're literally watching the forklifts, understanding how an order is picked off a shelf, how it's scanned in, how it's scanned out, how it's put on a truck and taken off site. But you have to understand then how to document the processes around that. So then management back at HQ can say, if we were to take this back in-house, we know how it's been done by our outsource provider. But also, yeah, look, I've been in boardrooms in Manhattan as well, presenting as well. So I don't know if you watch Succession, but the long boardroom table where you have about 60 people sitting at the table and 30 or 40 people on the outer seats. So it's very varied. I was in a march as well in Kilkenny. There was a vote with a co-op. So that was interesting, seeing the farmers coming in. And it was, from my farming background, I enjoyed it, but I'm not sure if some of my colleagues who grew up in urban areas understood the dynamic as well as I did.
Very good. All right. Obviously, there can be big businesses too, especially in Ireland. Agriculture is still giant and massive part of the economy. And I think, is it Dairy Gold still one of the biggest, or Kerrygold rather, one of the biggest businesses in the country? Yeah, I've had that as well. Funny enough, I remember I went on a trip to the States a few years ago. My first meeting was on Manhattan with D.E. Shaw Hedge Fund, a client of ours. And my second meeting was out near Bucage in Southern Texas in an orphanage. And they were very different setups altogether. And both of us, both clients. So I guess that's the variety. It's the spice of life. So we're going to get tucked into here a little bit. We're going to get into your banking experience and what you worked in corporate finance. And that's one of those terms that I've heard. And some people go, I work in corporate finance. And I nod along going, oh yeah, that's great. Pretending I know what they were talking about. But in truth, they don't. So this is my chance. What does corporate finance mean when I hear that?
Yeah, the way I'd explain it is corporate finance and funding are brother and sister. So on the corporate finance side, you're talking about mergers and acquisitions. Also, what's almost directly the inverse of corporate finance is insolvency practitioners. So during a boom, you could be helping companies buy or sell. In a recession, you could be helping companies stay afloat or an orderly liquidation of a company. But on the funding side, the way I would look at funding and what comes into treasury and stuff like that, and banking and funding, is to very simplify a complex area, I would look at it as resources and advances. What does that mean in layman's terms? Resources are deposits and advances are loans. So somebody has excess cash that they want to call it invest or lend to somebody else. They want the sum of money they've lended or invested back, but they also want a return on that. So call that interest, call that dividends or what you like. But on the advances side, it's either a loan or an equity stake in the business. So if we're going back to your asking me about corporate finance, on the corporate finance side, if one company is buying another company, how are they going to buy that company? Do they have excess cash on their own balance sheet that they can just buy it straight with cash? Do they want to get funding themselves? So do they have a third party backer, whether it's a venture capital firm or a private equity firm that's going to pour capital into them and then they'll buy the business? And there's a kind of a relationship there on both sides. So it's, I don't know if it is that making sense the way I'm explaining it there. But
what you've told me there reminds me a bit of the 80s or 90s movie, Brewster's Millions. You're probably too young to remember.
I know, I'm old enough to remember. I just don't remember.
There's a guy and he was gifted an inheritance, which he had to spend in something like $5 million in 30 days or something. And if he didn't, he lost his much bigger inheritance of $50 million or whatever it was. And it sounds a bit like that. So you have a company with, let's say, a big balance sheet, big cash. They know they can get 7% in the stock market or whatever, where the company has ambitions for improving that. If they were going to do that, then the argument then would be, why invest in this company at all? This company is there to beat the stock market. So they themselves have to figure out why they should justify the shareholders holding on to that cash if they're not going to beat that rate. Is that the conundrum?
Oh, no, absolutely. And then you can do share buybacks as well. And I think this year is the first year in a while that Warren Buffett hasn't bought back shares in Berkshire Hathaway. But I suppose with that as well is why do companies buy companies? So you could be either a financial buyer or a strategic buyer. So if I'm a strategic buyer, what's my strategic reason? Do I want to grow my market share in my own? So I'm going to buy a competitor. Do I want to get into a new market? So sometimes regulations can make it difficult for you to get into a new market. So the easiest way to get into a new market that's heavily regulated is buy an incumbent in the market. But then you could be a financial buyer and you could just say, I think this is a hot industry right now and there's higher returns. If I just purely take a financial decision on this and I buy this business, it's going to, you're just going to generate a higher return for me. But if I'm a private equity, I'm not going to be a passive seat on the plane here. I'm going to be driving the plane or sitting in the cockpit with the pilot, and I'm going to be actively running that business with the owners of the business. So it depends on your motivations as to why you're buying or selling.
Okay. So let's say there's a spectrum here, then what I'm hearing is you go all the way from just put it in an index fund like you would as a private individual in your pension or whatever. But then the problem with that is, and your argument is, how can you justify holding on to that cash? So then you need to do something better than that. And your problem is you need opportunities. So a financial buyer is someone who's just saying, listen, if I reckon I can reliably buy this company on a spreadsheet exercise, let's call it, and get better than 10% or whatever my hurdle rate is, then I'll do that. But then finding those opportunities they get snapped up.
Oh, no, they do.
So they're hard to find.
But sometimes you just have to go straight to them. So it could be somebody who's not looking to sell. So say with what I do, that's why I always encourage companies, you should be ready to sell even if you have no intention of selling. Because if someone comes to you and they want to buy the business off you, you want to put your best foot forward and you want to sell the business for what it's worth and for an optimum price for you. But good private equity, they have their ear to the ground. They have good contacts. They have good contacts in the accounting houses, in the banks. They have their ear to the ground. They're watching what's happening. They're seeing who's coming up, who's doing what. Is this an area I'm interested in? Because when I look at some of the private equities in Ireland, some of their investments make total sense because it's a value chain exercise. So say they buy your business and they buy my business. Well, I was a supplier or you were a supplier of me. So now we know that there'll be business done between the two of us even before we do business beyond the group. So you know that you're even just guaranteeing some revenue to your own stable of clients by buying with it across a value chain. And then they'll look at other areas as well to diversify. So when I look at some of the private equities in Ireland, I go, I can see the strategic decision-making by the management behind the portfolio clients. There's strategic decisions around value chain of businesses in the same group, but not competing businesses, businesses that complement each other, going after the same customer or bring the same customer on one journey. Or it could be unrelated areas where you're diversifying your pot, but also you're having high risk, medium risk, low risk. So going back to you're talking about the hurdle rate and the 10% hurdle rate, you have to accept some level of risk as well.
But that's the other thing. I think risk is seen as a valuable commodity. If you're looking for an opportunity, people understand that risk and reward go together and it's managing the risk, but you are actually seeking out opportunities. That's why we have VCs and startups on one end, and you have, and maybe let's talk a little bit about Ireland, the investment landscape here. Like the typical thing that I think we've seen a lot here is, for example, wind farms. They're going up all around the place and they're seen as a low risk investment, if you like, for something like a bank. So how would that work in your corporate finance world? Would it be wind farms coming to you directly, or would it be business brokers? Would it be investment bankers? Because there's terms here. Investment bankers are basically middlemen. And so the middlemen will be coming to you saying, I've got these three opportunities. Would it be funds directly? Who would be feeding into the banks trying to pitch them?
So if you're in the bank, say with wind farms and the like that, like they should have a very comprehensive business plan. So what's on the wind farm's business plan? First thing, very important, is planning permission. So they have full planning permission. So if you're getting married in the morning, what are the big things we need to box off straight away? So you're thinking in the same mindset. The things I need to box off straight away here is full planning permission. And then with ESB or on the grid, you want to have a fixed...
So ESB is the electricity...
So you know that you have a fixed price agreement for the energy you supply. Mm. So you have that locked in with somebody. So you might have a 7-year contract at whatever energy we generate off the wind farm, somebody has a contract in place which is to buy that. So now if you're looking to go to banks or investors to invest in the project with you, well, they're seeing it as less risky then, because they're going, because even if, so say I'm the prospector and I'm developing the wind farm. So they're looking at me and they're going to say, I believe in him. I think he can do it. But say for whatever reason, I can't deliver it. Well, they can go, well, we can pass that on to somebody else who can, because there's the planning there. There's a 5-year planning. Sure. And there's also the contract for the energy. So there's value in that contract and there's value in the planning. So there's inherent value right there straight away. So that's, you were talking about risk. So you're de-risking by having both of those in place. But also at a more economic, the greater economy level, it's the climate targets to 2030 in Europe. Ireland will be fined. The Irish government will be fined if we don't make the EU the targets that are set for us. So it's in the best interest of Ireland as a whole to be growing in this area.
Yeah. So you see these opportunities, like, so that sounds like a great business opportunity, right? So the risk seems low. If you're the contract in place with the network, you have the planning permission. It all basically comes down to cost control, my favorite topic, right? And deploying that. So when you're going to, it's just a question of managing your margin, because the top line is more or less fixed in those contracts, or you can't influence them anyway. So it's all about managing your margin. And certainly we have a couple of wind farm projects, which we help manage. And they do the biggest, those contracts are huge. You see the purchase orders going through are the biggest of any I've seen, absolutely huge amounts of equipment from Siemens and all the rest. And but then you're just trying to manage that underneath managing your costs. So anyone wants to do that, look us up, procurementexpress.com. I've got some software to help you with that. Put a plug in, might as well. So then the next step is, okay, so I understand maybe banks would be investing in those things. It's pretty solid. Things like infrastructure, whatever, data center development, stuff like that. And banks are all interested in. But how, so let's talk about the riskier, maybe a data center is slightly more risky because it's more complex maybe. And the contracts, depends how it works, maybe be more risk. And then beyond that, how far would something like a bank go in terms of funding on a major scale? I guess they have retail loans as well, but what are the steps between retail and, because each time the interest rate they're going to charge is going to go higher and higher, right, depending on how much risk involved. So what other things would they consider investing in?
Banks, they can invest in any area of the economy, like what you said, but the key thing is they're going to risk rate it, and it has to go to a risk committee. So depending on how risky they think it is, it's going to be a higher interest rate. But also, I suppose, like, banks are going to be like private equities as well. They're not going to put all their eggs in one basket. So if they already have lent a lot into wind farms, they might say, hang on, we need to start diversifying here, even within the industry. How about looking at some solar projects as well, or hydroelectricity or something else? Because we don't want to be fully on wind, you know what I mean? That we want other areas, but even just other areas of the economy. It could be other utilities, it could be other infrastructure projects, but it could be anywhere. And I know that's very vague, James, but I suppose at the end of the day, it comes back to risk.
I like that example, right? Because you talked about strategic buyers versus monetary buyers or financial buyers. But let's say you're heavily invested in wind and you're like, okay, what happens if there's some unforeseen problem with wind we haven't thought about yet? So I might be willing to pay a lower interest rate for something like, I don't know, coal or something that would balance that out, right?
Yeah. So so in the past more, but nowadays, like if you're investing in coal or brown coal, it's you're not hitting your sustainability targets as a bank. And you could have activist investors who'll come in, clip your wings fairly quickly on you or embarrass you publicly on it. But back in the day, you would have diversified across the energy sector. But say if you take if we take large scale projects, large investment projects, whether it's building a school, building a motorway, laying pipeline for a gas network, solar, wind, etc. Solar and wind are actually quite low risk from a project completion on time, on budget. You're talking about procurement and what you do. But generally, like, why is Lego such a good brand? Because it's smart. It's smart the way, the ultimate design of Lego is smart. It's building blocks. But there's that modular element to wind farms and to solar. So I wouldn't be surprised if half the electrical engineers on those projects were big Lego fans back in the day, because now you're but you know what I mean? Like, you're talking about the Siemens parts and stuff like that.
Well, that's it. I guess if you need more capacity, you build more, get more planning permission, et cetera, et cetera, which makes sense. I guess what I'm trying to get across here, what I'm hearing from you, is that we often consider raising capital as a problem that you need to do, but actually deploying capital is just as much of a problem, and probably, I think I'm rather be raising it than trying to deploy it. To be honest, it sounds scary to me.
Oh, for sure, yeah. And like I say, with startups, especially with startups, what do startups generally spend their money on? Sales and marketing and product development.
Yeah. The one thing Enterprise Ireland won't give you money for here in Ireland. They'll give you for everything else, but not the thing you need. But anyway, we'll leave that alone. Enterprise Ireland is the development agency here in Ireland, and they are great. They give you funding. They gave us funding. Thank you very much if you're listening. But they don't fund marketing and sales, which is actually the one thing you need to get a business going.
But anyway, but the problem with that as well is, so if I play devil's advocate and I pretend I'm Enterprise Ireland for a moment, it's they're putting a lot of that money gets squandered potentially. But again, it's having really good sales and marketing people with you, strategic people. So it's that you have full justification of the spend. Why? So you basically have done your homework. You understand your customer persona, who's the buyer of my product, and that money, I'm putting it in there because if I put it into that ad platform or whatever area, that's the one that gets the best results. That's the one that's getting the best results. That's the best value for money. You're talking about the deployment, that you can see the return on it straight away. And it's like everything. There's many, and you could take a private equity investor model to spend in sales and marketing money, because you could just put, you could put it fully into CRM and get, we all get the emails of through the CRM marketing campaigns, or you could sponsor something. You could invest it in networks, trade shows. There's so many different ways you can use that money. But it's like, how do you use that money in the best way to get the return for you? And again, it's, you'll only know looking back when the money is spent whether you've made the right decision or not. But I suppose, like, from what you know, what your business offers and what I offer is, do you have some kind of control over it as you go? Are you monitoring the initial spend when you're placing the bets initially? Can you say...
Well, it's all capital allocation, not just at different levels, right? So it comes all the way down to your the company level, and you're deciding who to hire and whether to go for the fancy guy or the person you brought up yourself, or spending on ads. And it's all capital allocation and figuring out that return. It just gets difficult, right? Which I guess is why you'd want a fractional CFO. But before we get on to that and, you know, how you help clients like that, you mentioned sustainability there. And I saw a tweet coming out this morning from Ole Lehmann. He's a German guy. Sorry, Ole, if I'm pronouncing your name wrong. And he said that US GDP is 25 trillion today, and European Union GDP is 16, even though they were equal 16 years ago. And sustainability has been a big hot topic here. There's funding available for it. It's been hot within the banking sector and investments and insurance. It's started to come in. What's your take? Because I know you're interested in politics a little bit, so we'll talk about the economic politics of this. Is that, has that difference in policy started to hurt the EU, where they're focusing maybe on sustainability, which sounds good on paper, but we seem to be falling behind? Is that part of the reason for it?
Yeah, I suppose like all these things, it's too early to tell yet, but it's what do we know right now? You can have a kind of a philosophical debate of conscience, and is sustainability the right thing to do? That's just a simple question. Yes, but you don't want it to be nose in spite of face either. And it's, but again, we're talking about strategic. If you're comparing two strategies or two tactics or plans, is one the tortoise and one the hare? Does one look more attractive now and the other outstay it? Because we were talking about on the energy side and banks, there's a lot of activist investors. If you don't diversify out of oil and coal as banks, there's a movement of activist investors who will buy shares in the banks and kick people off the board of the bank if they feel that they're investing in harmful areas. But I suppose an area I'm very interested in is around, and it's probably my economics background, is around energy security, because energy security is huge. It's, if we take the German example, the German economy is under a lot of pressure at the moment. Before the war in Ukraine, it was very reliant on Russian gas. And now with the sanctions on Russia, it's hard for them to get gas. Also, in that economy, the car, if they export into the US, there's going to be big tariffs on potentially on the cars they export in. And the same in China, there's less of a demand for their cars there. So if you, from a German point of view, you'd say, how are we going to innovate? Because a lot of the great German innovation, and actually, sorry, just accidentally realized that the tweet came from a German and I'm focusing on the Germans, but a lot of the great German innovation in that Ruhr Rhine Valley came in the late 1800s. So I would say at a global level, maybe it's a crossroads for people to sit down and go, right, what's our next move? What's our next play here? And can sustainability be part of that? And I think I mentioned to you before as well, is I was talking with a fellow in Australia about a month ago, and you know what he said? And it's just, it's funny when some people say something very simply to you, go, yeah, why didn't I think of that? And you're annoyed you didn't think of it yourself. But what he said was, it reminds him of the three E's of economics, economical, efficient, and effective. But I'm talking about the long play. If your business and your economy is economical, effective, and efficient, how can you lose in the long run? Yeah, in the short run, it might not appear that way. But we were just chatting off recording as well. And I suppose the other thing I would add to it that I said to you before we came on it is, it's even where is the money? The money has been in Silicon Valley. So if I'm the EU and we're sitting down in Brussels or Frankfurt going, how can we change that and get a movement of capital into the EU to invest in EU companies? And you're right, James. I can see where that German guy's coming from, because when you look at the global tech companies, there's not many European ones on it. They're all American.
He gives an example here. Is America has produced $9 trillion companies in the last 16 years. Europe, zero.
Yeah.
So, and that's a quote here. The ones we all know now, Tesla, Nvidia, Microsoft, etc.
Yeah, and
so,
do you know what I would push back on that as well, as I'd say, is a lot of the founders of those incredibly successful companies, and they are, the success they've achieved is amazing, is what a lot of them have in common is they weren't born in the US.
That's the thing. They've encouraged they've got founders, Irish
absolutely.
Founders.
We have some amazing Irish companies like Stripe and Intercom, but they all knew they had to go to Silicon Valley. That's where the show was at. So how do we bring the show back to Europe? I suppose that's the short answer to the question is, if we want to close that gap, bring the show back to Europe from a capital investment.
In the current business environment here in Ireland, because you work with clients primarily in Ireland, as I understand it, given that the structure we have here and everything, how do you help local companies navigate the, you know, what we have? We can't complain about what is not here, right? So the entrepreneurial attitude in Ireland is different than it is in the US. Sometimes we're seen as chancers, oftentimes kind of chancers. It's not as esteemed. I think it's changed a little bit. But when you're working with clients, where are your go-to moves to maximize the value you can deliver for them?
With them, initially, as you know, when we're having kind of a chemistry session to see, are we right for each other to work with first? Because I think that's very important before I even take them on. I want to understand what's their ambition. If they want to flat line and just trudge along, I'm probably the wrong person for them. But if they have a genuine ambition, I will help them in every facet and area of it and go on, how do we export? So again, it's going back to what I was saying about buyers and strategic buyers. But how can you do that organically? Go right. What's a good test market? Where we're lucky like we're on the periphery of Europe, but where we're lucky is we're right beside the UK market. The UK market is still one of the biggest markets in the world. And then we look west and we see the US and Canada. What do we all have in common? We all speak English. So it's a great leveler for us. So there are markets we can easily get into, and they're important markets for us. So I suppose when I'm advising companies, we're looking at, what products do you currently offer? Are they attractive into new markets or not? Is there an export potential there? So then we will speak to the local enterprise office, depending on their size, or Enterprise Ireland, to say, will you back us on that journey as well? So I know you're saying that they may not necessarily give you enough funding towards sales and marketing, but they have offices around the world. You know what I mean? And I lived in Canada. I lived in Canada from 2016 to 2019. When I lived in Canada, Enterprise Ireland and the IDA were in Toronto. They had the embassy, obviously, in Ottawa. But they opened consulate offices then in Toronto and Vancouver during that time. So from an Irish government point of view, there was strategic moves to open new consulate offices to help these startups if they want to grow into new markets. And there's a good Irish network anywhere you go around the world. But I suppose going back to what you're asking is are they ready? Are they ready to go into the market? Sure. Do they have something that is worthwhile? But also, going back to the more bread and butter stuff, it's looking at their margins, looking at their current performance. Are they optimally performing versus their industry, versus their peers? So say with one of my clients, one of the things I did is I looked with him, and it was an interesting one. I did a benchmark with him on about 7 companies in his industry, and they were all, their margins and their growth and everything was vis-a-vis their size. He was slap bang in the middle. He had 3 smaller and 3 larger. So I was actually showing him both things. I said, this is where you can get to. If you're not careful, you can fall back to this, or these guys can catch up with you. So he could, and I was explaining to him why they had larger sales and larger margins than him, why the other ones didn't, and what he could do about it. But that's just literally on the domestic market now, James. That's even just more, well, what can I do locally before I even look abroad? But it's understanding the performance of the business. Is the business performing? Is it? And we could just apply the 3 to that. If we looked at economical, is the price right for him and is the price right for his customer? How does he set his prices with his customers? What way does he do it? Is he responding to competitors or is he showing leadership with how he prices? And then efficient and effective as well. So say with that particular client, he's a dream client. We're talking about chemistry. He takes on advice. He appreciates the advisors that come into his business, but he's continuously improving operations. There's lots of efficiency coming out, and that's driving margins. So he's growing his gross margin and his net margin.
Yeah, that's what you want. I mean, I've said this before in the podcast. We did a mastermind there last week or the week before, and the first person came up saying, "I'm a fractional CFO and I can't find enough clients." The second person came up and said, "I'm a fractional CFO and I'm trying to get rid of clients." People who are not listening to me. Yeah. So
they could connect.
Exactly. All right. So let's pivot on to a little bit about how you're developing your own practice here. I know you're part of a network in Ireland, Agile.
Yeah, Agile Executive. So with Tony Dignam. So I think the last count. We started out as fractional CFO. And fractional finance directors, but it's now fractional executives. So we have about 70 people in the network and continuously growing. It could be more than 70 now, so I could be doing the guys a disservice. It would have been initially it was finance directors. More of them had grey hair than I had, so I'm one of the younger ones, if you like, but I'm saying that as a positive. I've over 20 years experience and I'd be one of the lesser experienced people in the network.
Yeah.
But we have sales and marketing, branding, CTOs, sustainability, tax credits, and tax. Just a brilliant group of people who advise companies, whether it's on the digital, sustainability, just how to grow the business. Everything we just discussed there and basically in partnership with our economic development agencies like Enterprise Ireland, the local enterprise office, and other industry groups that help startups and small and medium-sized enterprises and grow. So that's been a great network for me to be part of. But I suppose that's the network I'm working with. And like that, it's a great network for referrals of work to each other, and we all help each other. We have our own, of course, we have our WhatsApp group, like every good group has, but the information that's shared on that is incredible. It's really helpful for everyone in it.
Yeah, no, I think this is a great piece of advice for people looking to build a practice. I see it here. The successful fractional professionals are aligning themselves with groups, and it helps with your capacity. So when you get too much work, and it helps with your deal flow for getting new work, which is the classic problem of a services business. And this is a really smart way to do it. And I do it myself within the SaaS business. I'm in part of something called SaaS Rise, which I found to be very good as well. And it's a good approach. Very good. So how can people reach out to you, Joe?
Yeah, I'm obviously on LinkedIn, and then my website is www.intrinsiccfo.com. And I'd love to hear from people. And I suppose you were asking me about my own business. I help with the three stages: the start, the grow, and the exit. So it's, if you come in at the start, we'll build a business from day one with how can we make this attractive for an exit. Because the exit, and I know we haven't really touched on it much here today, James, but exit is inevitable. So that's the bad news for anyone who thinks they're going to live forever. But it is inevitable. It's fact. I'd look forward to the man or woman who can contradict me on that statement. But that's what I love doing. It's just making the best use of the time you have in your business.
Very good. Very good. So I'm gonna wrap it up then by asking you my traditional question to finish up here, which is, who is your business hero and why?
Yeah, and I think I said it to you in advance as well. It's going to be a corny answer. It's small business owners. It really is. And if I just pick one industry at the moment, you go into your local cafe, like what they've gone through in the last 5 years is incredible. The cost of living, wage increases, COVID, everything. And we all know we've our favorite cafe or restaurant that's been around for 10 or 15 years. The fact that they're still going, they've gone through all that turmoil. It's amazing what they do. And they employ, like a good cafe or a good restaurant could employ 25 to 50 staff. And people don't realize that, because you might only be taking, it might be one person taking your order and one person serving you. But it's all the people in the kitchen, all the other people as well. That's a lot of stress. I live by the coast here, and I remember going for a walk one evening during COVID, and I was walking back against one of the local restaurants. I never seen a man so stressed, and it just reminds you like what they do, and it's just incredible. And hats off to them.
I'm the same. I remember when I was a nipper in business, let's say, growing up, and I used to look at people who owned a cafe thinking, oh, they're brilliant, they're king of the world, and they own a business, and they are. But I didn't realize the effort and the lifestyle that goes into something like that, and it's a service obviously to the customers, but a community in a lot of places, every town or village. What do people ask for? What they want, it's your local pub, the local cafe. That's what actually makes you know, the these days, especially. All right. Thanks very much, Joe. And thank you very much for listening to the Gross Profit Podcast. Your special reward for being interested, myself and Joe today, is you can go to procurementexpress.com/partners. I've recorded a webinar which explains how you can, specifically for fractional CFOs, and explains how two things. One, how I think fractional CFOs can better sell their own value. No offense, Joe, but a lot of fractional CFOs are terrible at explaining their own value. And I've got my take on what they should say instead. And also within that webinar, we have a case study of Ben de la Creta. He's one of our fractional CFOs that we work with, and he uses Procurement Express as part of the playbook. So when he goes into a client that needs to control costs, let's take that wind farm we were talking about earlier, he's able to control those costs instantly without having to deploy an ERP, importantly. And that's what we do. So thanks for that. Joe, you've been fantastic. Thanks for coming on to the show.
No problem. Delighted. And thank you for inviting me, James. And best of luck with your business and your podcast. And congrats on the podcast.